Okay, I think in the interest of trying to end on time, we should actually start on time. I'm very pleased to welcome you all to what is tonight the third of our public lectures, our Voting Power in Practice public lectures, which are sponsored by the Leverhulme Trust. Voting Power and Procedures is an organization that was started in 2000 and is located at the Center for Philosophy and Natural and Social Science here at the LSE. And a year later, after its founding, it was given a small grant by the Leverhulme Trust for 3 years. And the output was so outstanding and well-received and prodigious that extraordinarily, last year, they decided to fund us for yet another 3 years, but for a rather unique and novel project within the confines of the academic arena called Voting Power in Practice. Now, the idea, the key idea of this project was to bring theoreticians together with practitioners and their advisors, practitioners in the realms of the economic, financial world, and in the political world, government, and so on. And theoreticians, essentially, who work in voting power and voting procedures. And the idea would be to consider some of the most important areas of legitimate representative rule and regulation within institutional governance, whatever that may be, whether corporate or political. Now, to this end, VPP annually hosts a workshop which is an intensive 3 or 4 day event somewhere, usually closed, that combines practitioners and theoreticians. And in tune with that, to follow somewhat in the theme of what the workshop sets out, the idea was to have a more user-friendly public lecture. And this is the third of such events. Tonight, the speakers will consider essentially the problems of reform of the international financial organizations. Now, we couldn't have had a better introduction to this than the fact that the G20 nations met last weekend in Washington. And it's kind of in the old hippie parlance, probably not an understatement to say that not all is well in the garden. And our speakers will address the issue tonight and how the failure of the governance of the international financial financial authorities have actually failed in their role as surveyors of the situation, as regulators of the situation. And so the current crisis will be looked at critically by both speakers from different points of view. And the particular focus will be on the International Monetary Fund. We're privileged this evening to have two very distinguished speakers, Professor Ariel Buira, and Dennis Leach. In keeping with the theme of a theoretician and a practitioner, Professor Buira will occupy the role of practitioner, and Dennis Leach will occupy the role of the theoretician. Ariel is a member of the Mexican Council of Foreign Affairs, and he's been a member of the Board of Governors of the Bank of Mexico. That's similar to the Federal Reserve Bank in the United States and the Bank of England in this country. And he was director of the G24 Secretariat and executive director of the IMF. His recent publications include Reflections on the International Monetary System, which he wrote in 1995, An Alternative Approach to Financial Crisis in 1999, Challenges to the IMF and World Bank in 2003, and in 2005, the IMF and the World Bank at 60, and Reforming the Governance of the IMF and the World Bank, he wrote in 2005, in the same year. So he's been an observer, a very keen and astute observer of this scene for quite considerable time. And both speakers will show that, in fact, perhaps the lay public don't really know how the IMF has sort of trundled on since its foundation in 1944 at Bretton Woods. But there have been, it's been under very close scrutiny for a considerable period of time. Dennis Leach is a professor of economics at Warwick University and a co-director of the Voting Power and Procedures program here at the LSE. He's done pioneering work on the theory and practice of voting power analysis, especially in developing appropriate algorithms. He's done seminal research and published on qualified majority voting in the EU Council, on the Nice and Lisbon treaties most recently, as well as the Bretton Woods institutions. He's presented his research to the G24 on reform of the IMF, the European Parliament's Economic and Monetary Affairs Committee, on coordination of the EU member states and their representation to the IMF and the World Bank, and at a recent roundtable on reform of the IMF organized by the World Economic Forum at a G20 meeting. Now, just before the speakers start, the essential way we'll do this is Ariel will speak for 30 minutes, I will introduce Dennis, he will speak for 30 minutes, and the remainder of time, approximately a half an hour, will be given over to yourselves for any questions you'd like to raise. So Ariel's talk tonight is going to be financial crisis and the international monetary system. Ariel Buida.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very honored and very grateful to Dennis Leach and to Rudy Farah for having me here, and to you for coming. I think it escapes nobody that the world economy faces its most severe crisis since the Great Depression. Much of the world is entering a deep and prolonged recession, and there is a risk of deflation. The international monetary and financial systems are in disarray. The current situation is characterized by undercapitalized banks, credit astringency, large and protracted global financial imbalances, exchange rate volatility, and after an upsurge, a sharp drop in the prices of commodities and oil. So what went wrong? How did we get here? Well, in this presentation, I shall try to address these issues. Following the end of the World War II and of the Asian crisis a decade ago, the IMF was the most powerful international financial institution in the world. It exercised supervision on the international exchange rate system and on the conduct of monetary affairs. It could rescue countries faced with external imbalances and debt crisis. Since then, we've seen the erosion of the major institution for cooperation, and the world economy faces a financial crisis and a severe recession without a coordinated international response. In the current circumstances, the fund should perform at least three roles: advise countries and groups of countries on economic policies, provide financial support in sufficient amounts to countries facing payments difficulties, avoiding thus a contraction in economic activity destructive of national and international prosperity, and help members, particularly systemically significant economies, to coordinate policies to prevent global inflation and recession. Of course, the value of or usefulness of the institution is determined by the support and advice it gives countries. To sustain a stable international monetary environment and a growing international economy. But as has become apparent in the current crisis, the IMF has yet to make a contribution to this. Now, over the last couple of decades, the world has undergone major changes. Countries like China, Korea, India, and others in East Asia have advanced very rapidly in terms of GDP and accumulated huge international reserves. Oil exporting countries have also experienced high rates of growth and hold very high levels of reserves, as well as sovereign wealth funds that give them unprecedented power. On the other hand, the U.S. and several countries of the European Union lost competitiveness and became increasingly indebted. Okay.
So
what did you press then?
Which did you do?
That's what I did.
The middle one? Okay. 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 Very good. Now, so some 64 years after the creation of the fund, we are focused with an international economy and international monetary system that are in crisis. And you can see here that over the last 12 or so years, we've had huge payments imbalances.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, this was the picture at any one point. You have US with a deficit of nearly 800 billion, China with a surplus of around little under 400, the rest of Asia a similar amount, oil exporting countries with large surpluses. This is the image of the current account of US and China. You can see there's almost a symbiotic relationship. The Chinese have very large surpluses and the US have very large deficits, and they sort of complement each other. The Middle East has also very large current account surpluses. They reach over 20% of GDP and a large accumulation of reserves. Asia is in a similar situation, about 8% of GDP on surplus on current account, and again a large accumulation of reserves. I have to go quickly because we don't have much time, but the point of this graph is to show that it's not just that they're having large reserves, but that they continue to invest. Their investment is growing, but the savings are growing more than their investment. So there is, you could say, a surplus of savings in the world. Now, this surplus of savings has given rise, well, this surplus of savings is largely, it's in a few countries, some in Asia, some in the Middle East, but the biggest surplus is in China. And the striking thing about China and the surplus is that despite having 1,800 billion accumulated in June and about 1,900 billion in reserves at the end of December, the exchange rate has not appreciated. And this is something that calls for an explanation. Normally, you have a huge amount of reserves, there's a pressure of the market to appreciate. So, what is the reason for this? Well, there are two reasons. Economists will tell you that according to the Samuelson-Balassa theorem, in its simplest form, there is greater technical progress and innovation causing the productivity per person employed to rise in the manufacturing industry, which is much faster than, productivity rises much faster than in services. So when you look at the consumer price index, rising at X or at not rising, the consumer price index overestimates unit labor costs, and you could maintain competitiveness even if you appreciate, let's say, 2 or 3% a year because you're rising productivity. But that's not the real reason. The main reason is sterilized intervention by the central bank. When you look, and I have the figures and I have the formula, but I'll just give you the the summary, which is that the top line is nominal GDP, the next line is growth in the supply of money, and the green line is growth in foreign assets. And the bottom line, which falls, is a contraction of net domestic credit. So, the monetary theory of the balance of payments would tell you that there is residents of any country have a demand for domestic money, currency, and bank deposits to use in transactions and as a store of savings. And if the authorities do not provide this money, they either have to contract activity or bring the money from outside, either borrowing or running current account surpluses or through direct foreign investment. Well, the Chinese have maintained an undervalued currency. They have not provided the, you can see the net domestic credit, the bottom line, contracting actually, and the accumulation of foreign assets rising. So, this was a growing current account surpluses leading to large reserve accumulation. And you have surpluses that were last year of the order of 12% of GDP, which is amazing. Now, this resulted, as I said, in a savings glut and led to a decline in world long-term real rates of interest. So real rates of interest, which were at some point at 4% in the mid-90s, were last year at around 2%. So you had accumulation of savings and a decline in long-term rates of interest. You also had, well, this is jumping ahead of it. Going to the U.S., you have a sharply expansionary monetary policy. You have the low rates of interest coming from abroad, and you have also a domestic policy of low or even negative rates of interest. Rates of interest in the U.S., long-term rates of interest were negative from 2002 to 2007, and this is the basis for long-term mortgages. You had federal rates at around 1%, which is the rates at which the Fed lends banks, and you have periods of negative interest rates in the short-term rates. Now, when I saw this, I said, well, of course, if you're running such rates, you would expect people to borrow as much as they can, because it's a great deal to, it's very cheap, it's virtually costless to borrow. And then you had the expectation that prices of real estate had been rising and would continue to rise. I have Ben Bernanke, who was then chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, stating in 2005 that house prices had risen by 25% in 2 years, and while there had been some speculation in a few places, increases at the national level reflected the strength of the economy, including the robust growth in income, employment, and the low cost of mortgages. And you had Mr. Greenspan saying there's no risk of a bubble. It's just a little froth, like in a, you know, at the top of a beer, but there's really no risk of a housing bubble. Now, you had then a strong demand for mortgages, which was fueled by the low rates of interest, by the expectation that prices would continue to rise, by securitization that allowed banks to give small borrowers access to capital markets and allowed financial institutions to discharge the lending from their capital. You made a package of mortgages, you called it, these are bonds, X bonds, I will sell them, I am Citibank or I'm whatever bank, and they are very safe paper because they're backed by real assets. And then you had the fact that the interest paid by borrowers was deductible from tax payments. So borrowers would get a tax relief for owner-occupiers would get tax relief uncapped for any amount of interest they paid. So, of course, if you interest rates took half of your payments and you could deduct it, even, and on top of this, rates of interest were very low or negative, then you were a fool not to borrow as much and to buy more. Then the rating agencies appear to have shared the expectation that house prices would continue to rise, and they took little care of the quality of debtors. They contributed to the bubble by advising banks on how best to package these mortgages, to sell them and rate them with a triple A rating. And they separated the rating part of the agency from the advisory part and pretended there was no conflict of interest. Then you had, of course, with this increase in house prices, you had a wealth effect. People who hoped to get a capital of $1 million found that they got there very quickly and they didn't have to save anymore. You had a wealth effect, and you could increase your consumption, you could buy a car, you could buy a yacht, you can go on holiday, and so on. Now, when I saw this, I expected that that you would have a balance of payments problem. And you would have a balance of payments problem because the external debt of the US was rising very fast, and in a few years, say six or so, you would get to 100% of GDP external debt, and a few years later you could get to 150%, and at some point people would find that they had more dollars than they wanted to hold, and they wouldn't want to continue being paid in dollars. They would want other things, other currencies. And what you already saw was that the composition of international reserves had fallen from 95% dollars to around 65% dollars, and the rest was mostly euros. But before this happened, you found another problem. Well, you find here how the savings rate, household savings rate in the US fall while they much more than in other, say, more much more than in European countries. Then you have that the personal savings rate become the lowest in history. They go from around 11% to negative numbers in a few years. And then people who held equity, well, this is perhaps too much detail. People were borrowing 100% of the value of the house. They were borrowing without appropriate documentation. Banks were getting very careless. And you had combined loans rising to high proportion of the value of the house. Now, you have people who had a house and initially say they had equity for 85% of the house, but the value of the house kept rising. And they said, well, why don't I get a second or a third mortgage and I can buy two new cars and buy that boat that I wanted? So the equity dropped. And you have this in which household debt, which is the green line, rises as a percentage of GDP from around 60% to 130-something percent in a short period of time, and personal savings rates fall from around 12% to around almost 0%. So a huge this saving. It's a, you know. Now, this, of course, this is huge expansion in demand, was reflected in a very large current account deficit. Deficits on current account of 6 or 7% of GDP. Now, if anybody else had deficits of 6 or 7% of GDP, as we've seen in Latin America and elsewhere, you would get a run on the currency, you'd get a balance of payments crisis. But in the US, there was this, this country that was living, spending more than it earned. Imports were much higher than exports. Why did the authorities pursue such expansionary policies? Why didn't they do anything about it? Well, the answer would be that since the growth of imports reduces domestic demand and produces a drag on domestic production and employment, if you buy a Japanese car, you don't buy an American car, and you employ less people, the Fed kept expanding the credit to keep everybody employed and to keep the growth rate growing. And this seemed not to be a matter of concern to the authorities, because they thought this was largely determined and financed by markets, and if markets didn't want to finance it, the imbalance would disappear. Now, this is associated also with a former UK Chancellor, Mr. Nigel Lawson. It was called initially the Lawson Doctrine. But of course, it forgets that if there is a loss of confidence, lending can disappear from one day to the next, but the economy will take several months to adjust, and you will have a crisis. Now, of course, there was a failure in U.S. policy. And it was bound to end in a crisis, whether it ended in a balance of payments crisis or it ended in this sort of situation that we face now, the real estate bubble causing the decline in savings and falling confidence and so forth. This was a major failure of policy. Now, despite the global significance of the U.S. in the world economy, there was no effective surveillance over it. The IMF is charged by statute, by Article 4, to exercise a surveillance function, both over China on its exchange rate policy and over the U.S. So there was a major failure of the IMF to perform its duty. There were a lack of checks and balances. There was the overarching power of the U.S. over the IMF, charged with the responsibility of surveillance. You may note that neither the IMF nor the G20 nor anybody else had much to say before the crisis. And even after the crisis, they've been very tentative in their criticisms. So the fundamental question might be whether the IMF is able to deal with the current problems of the international monetary system, whether it has the power to discipline large countries that do not borrow from it. I mean, it can discipline Hungary or wants to borrow and demand that it take contractionary measures and so forth. By the way, it's very interesting to note the contrast. When the Asian crisis erupted in 97-98, the IMF with the US Treasury went hand in hand and asked that Korea or several other countries that were involved increase their interest rates to 25-40%, whatever. It was demanded that they balance their budget and that they devalue sharply. And this provoked a lot of resentment in these countries because they felt that these measures aggravated the crisis. In the case of Korea, that had been closed to foreign investment in banks, industrial conglomerates, insurance companies, and so forth, the devaluation of 95% and the opening meant that Citibank could buy half of the things at fire sale prices, and they resented this, and they still do. So what they decided was that from then on, they would accumulate reserves and never be subject to this sort of risk again. Okay. So, Article 4 of the Articles of Agreement of the IMF say that members must collaborate with the fund to ensure that exchange rate policies do not impair the orderly balance of payments adjustment process. And what you see is that what Korea or countries in Asia, Indonesia, Thailand, whatever did, was exactly the opposite of what the U.S. has been doing. They have expanded the deficit, they've cut their interest rates, and they expect to have a further stimulus. Well, there's a lot more to say about the IMF, but since I've been told that I'm running out of time, let me just put some conclusions to you. First is that even the world's most sophisticated financial system can make major mistakes. And being the largest economy, its impact on other countries is very considerable. There was excessive deregulation and no early warning system on issues of supervision, capitalization, and so forth. Second, not only are we faced with the consequences of a major regulatory failure that allowed an undercapitalized quasi-banking system that is in fact larger than the banking system under the supervision of the Fed or other bank regulators, composed of mortgage institutions, broker-dealers, investment banks, structured investment vehicle conduits, and so forth, to expand credit and to flourish undercapitalized and largely unsupervised. Fund surveillance failed. A strong case can be made that the policy of large-scale sterilized intervention in the exchange market as pursued by China, which leads to large and persistent current account surpluses and to large accumulation of international reserves, can be characterized as exchange rate manipulation and therefore be said to hinder the balance of payments adjustment process. One could equally argue that the large and persistent current account deficits of 12, 14 years reflect the excessively expansionary fiscal and monetary policies of a country that has been living beyond its means, and that because of its size and importance as a supplier of the main reserve currency, poses a threat to the stability of the international monetary system. In the past, the fund has had considerable influence over countries that borrow from it, but it has had very little influence over surplus countries or very large countries that can exercise political influence over it. This is, of course, a major shortcoming of the international monetary system that must be remedied. The fund has no teeth. It has done nothing about global imbalances, and it has exercised no discipline over the U.S. as the main reserve currency country. And as the global economy becomes increasingly integrated, developments in major economies have immediate repercussions on others. Thus, in the current crisis, concerted action is called to boost the world economy. There is a need for policy coordination within a cooperative institutional framework that can prevent or diminish the impact of economic and financial crisis. This would be the role of IMF, but one that has not yet been able to perform. If you look at the recent G20 meeting, you know that a number of countries agreed to expand their economies to adopt Keynesian policies, but there was no estimate of how large the overall expansion should be. There was no target for what the Germans, the Japanese, the Chinese, the Americans, and so on should do. So it's there, it's sort of, you will do what you said you would do. We're not going to put any targets. We're not going to add it up. We're not going to see if this is enough, whether you should do more or you should do less. It's obvious that if, you know, for instance, in the European Union, where countries have something like 70% of the trade amongst themselves, the impact of an expansion in Germany on the Europe as a whole is different from an expansion in Germany plus Italy, France, Spain, UK, and so on and so forth, because they would reinforce each other. As we have it, Germany is proposing a very small expansion. We still don't know what the UK will do, although it says it will do more. France is now, Spain is now going for the second helping. Italy and France haven't said anything what they will do, and so on. And on supervision, well, it's like saying, well, you carry on doing what you were doing, try and do it a little better. But the US rejected any overall framework for supervision, for commitments to systematize and uniformize the requirements of capital or what the rules would be. Well, so we don't know. We don't know if this will work, if it will be enough, if we can go over the 3% Maastricht limit in Europe, or whether we'll stay below, even if it isn't enough. So that's the situation. I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Aaron. And now Dennis will talk, and his title is In Search of Simplicity, Transparency and Democratic Legitimacy, obviously within the IMF. What about your handouts?
Yes. Okay.
Well, maybe people can pick them up afterwards.
Do you want to distribute them?
All right, I can distribute them.
Okay, there's a handout coming round, but there's only about enough for about half the audience, so if you just take one and pass them on and share the handouts if possible. Would it be possible to get my PowerPoint loaded? Okay. Okay. Does anyone know where my PowerPoint has gone?
Yes.
Good job, we've got a handout.
Where's my piece of PowerPoint? No. Yes. Yes. I was told it was on here.
I have a USB stick, however.
No, that isn't. That's your USB stick.
Oh no, yeah. This is your USB stick. That's the mouse pointer. I'm sorry, it's meant to be on.
Yes. Number one, yes. Right, come on. That's it.
Okay. Got it. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sorry about
okay,
that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, this isn't quite the same, the final version. Anyway, doesn't matter. So I'm going to focus on the system of governance of the IMF, and in particular the system of voting, which has been in existence ever since the IMF was founded in 1944. I'm going to talk about first the voting rules in the IMF. The voting rules in the World Bank follow those of the IMF, so we don't really need to consider them separately. They are both really very similar. I'm going to then talk about voting power analysis, which is the focus of, which is the theme of these lectures, really, and I'll explain what I mean by that. And then I'll talk about the recent decisions to redistribute votes that were taken in earlier this year, and then I'll make some comments about the 85% rule, which is the fundamental rule by which changes in the IMF are decided, and then some proposals to I'll present some analyses of changes in the basic votes, and then finally I'll try and say something about democratic legitimacy, and I will make reference to one idea called the Penrose square root rule as a way of giving democratic legitimacy to a system of weighted voting. So let's those are the topics I'm going to try and cover in the next half hour. Simplicity, transparency and democratic legitimacy are the three kind of principles I'm trying to work in into the analysis. Simplicity, how easy are the rules to understand? Transparency, by transparency I mean, are they what they seem? Do they mean what they appear to mean? And specifically I'm going to focus on voting power and point out that there's a difference between voting power and the number of votes that a country has, and that's an important point, I think. And finally, democratic legitimacy. I'm going to say something about the fact that we're talking about countries which have electorates. So in terms of democratic legitimacy, we should be thinking not just about intergovernmentalism, but also in terms of countries which are possibly democratic. I know China isn't democratic, but let's think of an ideal world in which the countries which are members of an organisation like the IMF are democracies in which fundamental decisions are taken by one person, one vote. Right, so voting in the IMF and World Bank, there are 185 members. They all have seats on the Board of Governors. So I'm going to talk about the Board of Governors, not the Executive, which is the highest fundamental body, ruling body, governing body of the IMF. They use weighted voting so that each country has a number of votes which reflect the country's quota. Each country has 250 basic votes. Every country have 250 votes, and then they get one vote for each 100,000 SDRs of quota. In the World Bank, it's one vote for each share, which is related. The number of shares a country has in the World Bank is based on its IMF quotas. So that's the system, that's the formula for deciding on how many votes each country has in terms of its quota. So the question is, how are quotas determined? Well, the rules, the articles, contain no formula for quotas. They're silent on the question of quotas. They just simply say that each country's number of votes is based on its quota. It doesn't say where the quotas come from. And in fact, each country's quota is determined by the board. The quotas are political. They're determined by a vote. Every country's quota is determined by a vote of the Board of Governors. And so that's the key point to realise, that the quotas are not determined really by a formula, but they're determined by a political process. But the political process is guided by a formula. And in fact, rather than being a simple formula, there are five complex formulae. Now, these are the formulae that have been adopted in recent years. You can see there are five different formulae there. There's the original Bretton Woods. And you see Q1 is equal to 0.1y plus 0.025r, and so on and so forth. So basically, the formulae reflect gross domestic product. The reserves are the payments on the receipts, which is the openness of the economy, and the variability of receipts, we don't have to go into it in too much detail, except to notice that some of these numbers are beautiful because they are accurate to nine places of decimals. That shows that the formula must be really scientific. It's not political at all. That's amazing. Look how accurate that is. So we don't really need to worry about that. That's the formula. Now, that is actually no longer applicable. That has been changed this year, and I'll show you the new formula, which is supposed to be simpler than that, but I don't think it is. Now, that's simplicity then. I'm suggesting that it would be nice to have a formula for determining quotas, which kind of, as I said, underlies the process by which quotas are determined, which is simple. Now, transparency. By transparency, we mean, in this context, we're focusing on voting power analysis. The vote shares are often described as voting powers in the literature of the IMF. If you go to the IMF's website, it will tell you how much voting power Britain has, or the United States, or whatever. But these are not really voting powers, these are vote shares. It tells you how many votes each country has. The United States has currently, I think it's 16.77% of the votes. This isn't the same as voting power. Voting power is the ability of a country to affect decisions taken by voting. Voting power is a measure, is influence. It's the influence of a country rather than how many votes it has, which is not the same. In general, the two can differ by quite a lot, and they do, as I shall show you in a moment. So power The term power, as I say, connotes the ability to influence decisions, and voting power analysis looks at the relation between voting weight or voting share and voting power by essentially examining all possible outcomes of a vote that could possibly take place. So we envisage some general hypothetical vote in which each member could vote yay or nay, and then look at how many of those votes each member could influence, and that's the measure of the voting power. And the scientific name for the way in which we measure voting power is the power index, in particular the Banzer index, which is a measure of the share in the decisiveness of all voters. So this is where the algorithms come in that Rudy mentioned. We have to use sophisticated computer algorithms to calculate these power indices, particularly in a body like the IMF, which has 185 members, and it's extremely difficult to do these calculations without a certain amount of computer science. So that's, that lies behind the results I'm going to present. Okay, so... okay, well, my diagrams have vanished. My key diagram is not there. It's figure one, anyway. It's figure 2A on the handout.
Why don't you try using that?
That's
right.
Make it
that.
It's not loaded.
You see, it's there. That's it.
Okay. All right. Well, if you look at the handout, it's figure 2A. I'm afraid I'll have to put my glasses on to look at this. So figure 2A is the key diagram. If there's nothing else in this talk, it's figure 2A. In figure 2A, the represents the vote shares and the voting powers, calculated using the power index. These are the shares in the voting power. So the first bar, which is green, the darker bar, the first bar is the vote share, and you can see the figure for the United States there, the first one, is 16.77%. But its voting power is much greater than that. So you can see the implication of having such an unequal system of weighted voting is to concentrate, sort of enhance the power of the largest, the country with the largest weight, the United States, even more. So we have a system which is designed to be unequal, to reflect the different quotas in the different countries, whereby the voting power, the influence, is even greater. And you can see that all other countries have a voting power which is less than their nominal voting power, their vote share. So that's the key result, really, which shows that the IMF voting system, in terms of voting power, is not transparent. It lacks this this transparency, which is always assumed by when people talk about voting power in the IMF, and voting power is actually more unequal and benefits the United States much more than is apparent. And the next diagram, figure 2B, shows the ratio of power to weight, so that it shows the size of the effect in each country. And you can see that if the system were completely transparent, all of these bars would be equal to 1. The voting power and the weight would be the same, and so their ratio would be 1. But we can see that the United States' voting power is about 40% more than its voting weight. And all of the countries have a lower voting power than white. So there's this kind of hidden redistribution in terms of voting power towards the United States, towards the largest. So therefore, the voting rule is not transparent. So this, in our view, this is an important lack of transparency. And the IMF has, or it's universally recognised that the IMF needs to change its voting rules to recognise the emergence of the of countries like China and Brazil and so on. And at Singapore in September 2006, at the annual meeting of the IMF, the board resolved, first of all, to immediately increase the quota for four countries, underrepresented countries, and also to reform the the voting rules, and in particular, to come up with a new quota formula. So this has now been done, and in April 2008, the board decided to on a new quota formula and to adjust the quotas in the light of the formula, but not completely. The quotas of some countries, some rich countries, didn't take an increase, were not given an increase in their quotas, which the formula suggested they should have, but the quotas of a lot of poor and middle-income countries were increased. Also, the voting shares now include a tripling of the basic votes. So the basic votes now have gone from 25 to 750, but that's little enough. So this was presented with great fanfare by Dominique Strauss-Kahn and everybody in the IMF. The new structure represents an important step towards a redistribution of voting shares towards dynamic emerging market and developing countries, blah, blah, blah. And in fact, right, so let's just look at the new quota formula before we do the power analysis. Okay, this is the new quota formula. We don't have any numbers to nine decimal places anymore, but it isn't really what you call simple. The same four variables appear in the formula. Now the formula has a weighted average of those four variables. I'm not sure what the reason for that is, but the weights add up to one. So now there's a 50% weight on gross domestic product, and then openness is this the variable here, that's imports and exports, and variability of receipts and reserves. But then there's this power function here, this power K, known as the compression factor. So that enables anything to be done with it. It turns the formula into elastic, you see, and then so you can choose the compression ratio to achieve whatever ends you want. So this is a heavily non-linear formula. It's the same variables essentially as before, except that gross domestic product now is based on a blend of GDP at market rates and at purchasing power parity exchange rates. The developing countries favour purchasing power parity rather than market rates because market rates tend to underestimate the GDP of countries like China and overestimate the relative importance of countries like of some of the European countries and so on. So now it's an average of market GDP and purchasing power parity GDP, 60-40. So it's a slight improvement, but it's still not what you call a simple formula. Now, if you look at... I would say that if you look at the new vote shares based on this formula, don't justify the hype. And in fact, the changes to the formula, changes to the quotas, the tripling of basic votes, make almost no difference whatsoever to the distribution of voting power. And there's a simple lack of transparency. Now, if you look at figure 3, which is the next slide on page 5, of the handout, you can see the new vote shares and the power analysis compared with the original vote shares, last year's vote shares, and the power analysis for that. And in fact, there's a slight, although the voting weight of the United States has gone down a tiny bit from 16.8 to 16.7%, its voting power has actually gone up slightly from 22.8% to 23.8%, 24.3%. And the voting powers of the other countries are all pretty much as they were. So all this this change in the voting weights that have just been announced is completely nothing really, very little, almost no difference. Right, so that's, now I've been assuming up to now that voting rule is 50%. So we're considering ordinary decisions taken by weighted voting. Now, of course, as everybody knows, the really important decisions which are needed for reform of the IMF require a supermajority. In fact, the supermajority is as high as 85%. Major decisions, like changing the quotas, require 85% of the weighted votes to be in favour. Now, this, of course, ensures the USA has a unilateral veto with its 16.7%. So that's the reason why the IMF has this extraordinarily high voting threshold of 85%. But let's have a look at this rule. Let's do a power analysis of this rule, and we find that it's even more distorting. So if you look at figure 4A now, we have a voting power analysis with the 2008 weights. The 2008 quarters, and for the top 20 countries. The diagram only shows the top 20 countries, but obviously we've done the analysis for all members, all countries. So here you can see the second bar, which should be yellow, really, the second bar is extraordinarily equal, really. It's nowhere near as unequal as the voting weights. So therefore, the effect of the 85% rule is to completely undermine the whole idea of basing voting on quotas, to using weighted voting, because it works against it. It's very close to a rule which says that it's very close to a unanimity rule. 85% is a very high threshold indeed. So the effect is that that not only the United States has a veto, unilateral veto by itself, but then small groups of other countries also have a veto. And so the effect is to undermine the inequality in the voting rule, simply in order to give the United States this unilateral control. And so the 85% rule is far from being transparent. The next diagram shows the power ratios for the 95% rule, which shows that the power to weight ratio for all the small countries is very close to one. It's only the large countries which have a less voting power than their weight. Right. So the next analysis then is to increase the basic votes. Now, in 1946, the basic votes represented 11% of the voting, of the total voting weight of all the countries, and today the basic votes represent less than 2%. Now, the IMF have responded to this by tripling basic votes, so they're now almost 6%, but they're still a long way short of where they started out in 1946 when the IMF was founded. And of course in 1946 there were 44 members. Now there are 185 members. Maybe the basic votes, there are arguments for the basic votes to be increased well beyond the 11% to reflect the growth in membership. So we've considered increasing the effect of increasing the basic votes to 11% and then to 25% and 50%. And the effect we've found is surprisingly weak, really, in terms of the effect on voting power. Restoring the 1946 level, in fact, makes very little difference. And figure 5, if you can look at figure 5, we've got the four analyses there. We've got the status quo, where the basic votes are 2%, and then increasing to 11%. I don't mean the status quo, I mean the post-Singapore situation, where the basic votes were 2%, then 11%, 25%, 50%. So going to 11%, you see the second bar on the diagram for each country is not much different, really. So even if the basic votes were increased to 11%, it would not really undermine the main point, the main lack of transparency that I'm arguing exists. Right. So finally, let's say something about square root rules. Now, we considered doing analyses where we took the square root of population. We haven't considered basing votes on populations, but we've done an analysis of square roots of population. We've also looked at square roots of quarters as well. Okay. So you can think of taking a square root as like using a compression factor of a half instead of 0.95 in the formula that we looked at before, in a sense. Now, in fact, we can actually give a theoretical justification to taking the square root of population in terms of one idea of democratic legitimacy, which called Penrose's square root rule, which has been discussed extensively within the context of another system of weighted voting, the European Union Council of Ministers. And there has been a proposal made by a number of social choice theorists, led by some people in Poland, that in fact it would be a very fair voting system within the European Council of Ministers if each country's block, number of weights, each country's block vote, as it were related to the square root of its electorate or its population. Okay, in terms of one person, one vote, the idea is that within a country, the government is chosen, in a democratic country, the government is chosen by an election, let's say idealised as one person, one vote. And if then at the level of the IMF or the European Council of Ministers, if then voting powers were proportional to the square roots of the populations, that would ensure the theoretical result that voting power would be equal among all countries. So that's the voting power of voters, of individual electors. Okay, so there is this very elegant argument elegant mathematical argument in terms of probability that argues that an international body governed by weighted voting like the European Union or like the IMF could acquire democratic legitimacy if its voting weights were based on the square roots of the populations or the square roots of the electorates in the countries concerned. So that's an argument we would put forward for including at the very least, including a population element in the formula for the quota. And the second question is, can we justify an approach based on the square root of the quotas rather than populations? If we have to use voting based on money, can we provide a justification for this rule in terms of $1, one vote? Now, the analyses which are in the handout show that these rules actually appear to be very close to transparent, that power and weight are very close to one another. And so this suggests an approach which we'd like to argue for. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Okay, I think we've exceeded time because of technical difficulties and the like, so we will probably extend the question time if it warrants it for an extra 5 minutes or so. So can we have the questions? And if you could please adopt the well-respected convention of not giving a talk before you actually ask the question. So any questions from the floor? First one back there. And could you give your name, please, where you're from?
Yeah, Luke. Can you hear me? Luke Bowens from the LSE. This question for Professor Leach. I'm wondering, actually, about the independence condition when you talk about dollars rather than about persons. You know, you have to have that in place in order to do something analogous with the Penrose rule. Is that justified?
Well, that's my question. Yes, well, really, that's our question, really. Is it justified? Does it make any sense in terms of any notion of democratic legitimacy? We've been trying to think of an argument that would lead to the square root of the quotas having some democratic legitimacy. So we're trying to think of, in terms of individuals, who, taxpayers paying dollars to the, or paying cash, paying money to the government. But we've not really got our heads around it. That's the question, really. Would such a model? I know it's very, it would be very strange. But would it be? Does it make sense? You know, and we don't think it does. No. But it's an interesting question that maybe is worth thinking about, worth studying.
Over there.
Hi, I'm Oktay from the LSE as well, but I'm not a teacher, I'm just a student here. So this is mainly to Ariel Bura. You mentioned the reluctance of the IMF to implement a more robust supervision framework, and the US's sort of opposition to it. So is it mere rhetoric when Gordon Brown talks about a new Bretton Woods regime and other things like that? So how really are we going to have a fundamental change, or is it just going to be a slight rhetoric and slight change and then we're just going to carry on business as normal?
Oops. Well, that's... That's a question that hasn't been answered. You see, the inclination of the European Union and the US is to maintain the status quo to the extent that they can. And this is what they did in the last two reforms, both in Singapore and the more recent one in Washington this year. But I think they found that the system is broken and that the G7 or G8 are not by themselves able to fix it. So they found that they are no longer more than half of the world economy. They are no longer the most dynamic economies. They are no longer the largest holders of international reserves. And if they want to fix the system, they have to involve emerging market countries. And this is, I think, a fact. I think that the results of the quota revision that was happened earlier this year was very disappointing. The quotas, the new quotas, do not in any way reflect the relative position of economies in the world. And I'll give you some very simple examples. Under the new quota calculations, China has the sixth largest quota. It is smaller than that of France or the UK. And of course, it's smaller than Japan and Germany. Japan didn't want China to overtake it, but then neither did the UK or France. So, you know, this is the way it is. Under the new quotas, you have Belgium and the Netherlands having substantially larger quotas than Brazil or Mexico. But Brazil or Mexico are larger than the two combined. And you have China having a quota that is slightly smaller than the sum of Saudi Arabia plus Denmark. You know, this doesn't make sense at all. It doesn't make sense. So, when you go to the G20, you leave quotas aside, and you say, okay, gentlemen, we have this issue before us. What do you think? What can we do? And you don't have weighted voting. You have, obviously, a certain additional weight or presence of the US and so forth. But it's no longer this qualified majority or this weighted voting. So this is... The fact is that the new quotas continue to favor rich countries and continue to minimize the importance of developing countries. But when you come to the real world, you can't do certain things unless you get these other countries involved. So how far we will go, it depends very much on how people play their cards, but you saw... You found the Brazilians saying that they didn't like just being invited for coffee. You know? And this was a feeling. They asked China, would they lend money to the IMF because maybe the IMF has to play a larger role and needs more resources. And China said, well, maybe. What do I get for it? You know, what's in it for me? So this is the situation in which we're now facing, and this is perhaps the first time that it's come out so openly. I think it was Lula who said, you know, the G7 is dead. This is why we have the G20. The G7 is irrelevant now. So we are at the turning point. How far it will go, we'll see.
State first of all who you are.
Ben. Shukla, I'm simply a visitor to the LSE. Crisis that we are in today, does it make it easier for a meaningful reform of the IMF?
I think it makes it necessary. I think it makes it necessary. The old IMF, with the new formula and the new numbers, lack legitimacy, lack representativeness. And this is why countries walked away. After the Asian crisis, the Asian countries decided they would never go back to the IMF and started to build up reserves. And it is the fund ran out of customers for 8 or so years or 10, and they started and they found that their expenses were greater than their income, and they had to fire something like 500 and something staff members, and they started to think of selling part of their gold holdings to invest the proceeds in a way that would yield an income. Now, the current situation has brought Iceland, Turkey, Pakistan, and Belarus, and maybe one or two others to the fund, but it's these are countries that went virtually everywhere else they could think of before turning to the fund, because they don't trust the fund. They don't trust the way it's governed. They have disagreement with its fundamental policies, and they just go there because there is nowhere else to go. But I think that unless there is a major reform in the governance structure, as soon as the crisis is more or less overcome, they will go back of the way.
The first and then the lady behind this person.
Hi, my name is Fernando Moret, and I'm from the philosophy department here at LSE. And I would like to ask Ariel and Dennis if they have any idea about what kind of policy can work now to fix the problem, because now there is kind of tendencies. One is to push the banks to give credit, because social mobility was very important for politicians and for all of us. Or if we should rather to adopt some kind of policy of market contraction, which would take probably three generations for people to have some kind of social mobility. So on the one hand, we have credit to allow social mobility, the promise of capitalism, and it worked in Mexico with Salinas, in the States with Clinton and Bush a bit, and here with New Labour. That was credit. The other option is the market contraction. Then social mobility would take three generations for people really to buy a house, you know, three generations perhaps. So any idea what kind of policy, and if there is a policy to be really chosen to fix the system, the international system right now? Thank you.
Well, I think the choice was already made. It wasn't made perhaps explicitly enough or quantitatively enough. But the choice was made that, and the announcements were made, that Japan, China, we know the US, we know Germany, we know the UK, we know that Spain, we know that maybe others are going to go for Keynesian policies and, if you wish, credit expansion. Because they feel that the contraction is very costly in social terms, in economic terms. It'll take a long time, and it's not an efficient way of recovering. But contraction is the old IMF formula, and this is why people walked away from the IMF. This is why people said, never again, we'll find some other way.
Yeah, I mean, you can see the problem in the past couple of weeks, really, because for the first time, some countries have gone to the IMF for a bailout in the present crisis. Hungary and Ukraine, I think, and also Pakistan, and Iceland, of course. Iceland, yes. And and they've been told, well, you know, you've got to balance the budget and cut government expenditure, privatise anything that you can privatise. You know, liberalise markets and so on and so forth, as a condition for getting help from the IMF. Meanwhile, Britain and America are throwing everything at the crisis of avoiding a deflation. I mean, we're on all hands to the pumps, all hands to the Keynesian pumps in Britain and America. So you can see the governance problem really within Europe between the countries that are not going to the IMF, but which are answerable to their electorates, who do not want a recession caused by this banking crisis, and yet we're heading for it, and the government are saying we'll do everything it takes, and yet over in Pakistan they've just put interest rates up to a high level because as a condition for getting a bailout, and Hungary are adopting deflationary measures. So the need for reform of the IMF so that the wishes of the electorates in the countries are reflected in the governance is evident from that, I think, you know.
I think, no, there's a lot of questions, but we don't have a lot of time.
Can we have this woman here behind the last speaker, please, first?
Thank you. My name's Zoe Young. I run a website called Iffy Watch TV, which helps to raise the profile of alternative and grassroots perspectives on international financial institutions such as the IMF. I suppose my question is that given that this system has not been working for quite some time from the perspective of global social movements, churches, trade unions, it's more than 20 years since people have been saying, hang on, structural adjustment, this is connected with the voting system, the lack of transparency. You know, now that it's clear on a more global level and it's in all the mainstream newspapers and it's very much on the everyday news that this system is actively broken and we're speaking about a new Bretton Woods setup, what will it actually take to change the voting system now? I mean, Bretton Woods 1 took place during the Second World War when it was beginning to be clear who was going to be the victors there, who was in a position to start reshaping the financial architecture. What will it take? Will it need some sort of a insurrection?
Well, I think you've answered that. What will it take, right?
Yeah.
Could you answer that?
Well, I think it will take a... I mean, the point that Ariel made, that the world is changing, that now the 20 years ago, the countries that were the debtor countries are now the countries with a large... With the countries with the large reserves, and the biggest debtor country in the world is the United States. So the realities, the political realities based on money, have changed. And so I think that there's going to be have to be a change.
One question over here. Sorry, what's over you going?
Yeah, well, I might add a little comment. You know, when the fund started, fund resources were about 55% of world trade. Today, they are around 3% of world trade. Now, when conditionality, or let me put it this way, the harshness of the adjustment, the speed of the adjustment, the severity of the adjustment, depends on how much money you have. If you had infinite financing, you wouldn't have to adjust. This is what the US have been doing for the last 14 years. They just continue to spend. Now, if you have very little money, you have to adjust abruptly. If you had no financing, the adjustment would come overnight. Now, what happened was that as the European countries stopped going to the fund, they lost interest in maintaining the level of resources at an adequate level. And when you reduce the amount of resources of the fund, there is a direct connection between the amount of resources and the harshness of conditionality. So when you have less resources, programs are more severe. And you won't be surprised to hear that the rate of program failure rose very sharply.
Julian Evans, I'm a journalist. Is there a danger that the fund will run out of money next year?
Who are you directing the question to?
Dennis. No. Yeah.
Dennis.
Both speakers.
Sorry. Okay.
Yeah, look, the fund now has around $250 billion. If nobody went to the fund, it wouldn't need any more money. Now, there is the possibility that because of the closure of credit markets, which we've seen Hungary and Iceland and so forth go to the fund. Now, if the fund needs more money, it can borrow or it can choose to increase quotas. So far, the industrial countries had decided in the past, in similar circumstances, to borrow. They had the general agreement to borrow, which was something like $20 billion at some point, I'm talking about more than 20 years ago, and then more recently the new agreement to borrow was around 30 billion from countries that had a good balance of payments position. In the last few weeks, Gordon Brown and others, but Gordon Brown even went around to talk to the Chinese and to some of the Middle Eastern countries saying, well, we may need more money in the fund, could you lend the fund more money? But it's one thing to lend the fund more money, and then another very different one is to increase quotas. If you lend money, you do not increase your power in the fund, your influence over decisions. And this is what they asked the Chinese to do, and what they asked some of the Saudis. And the Saudis said, no, thank you, not in those terms. The Chinese said something like, what's in it for me? You know, the normal thing would be, yes, you need money, okay, increase the quotas, give me more voting power. But we'll have to see. It depends what, it's still early days, but it may be that you do have, Japan already said they would lend 100 billion to the fund. Now, if the fund with the 250 plus 100 more billion from Japan has enough money, it may stay that way. If it has to go with a hat around and ask for more people to contribute, they may be forced to increase the quotas. The Europeans, the US don't like that because it will diminish the relative position.
Add to that?
No.
Wait a minute. We've got two questions. Moshe, you can ask afterwards.
Thank you. My name is Mary Farrell from the University of Greenwich. I can see clearly that changing the voting rules is important in terms of legitimacy, and most of the countries who do not have the voting power are clearly in favour of this. But I wonder if this is enough in terms of a basic goal of the IMF from the beginning, which was global financial stability. And you know, we can see in the last few weeks that the IMF hasn't been very much to the fore in terms of addressing this. Now, it seems to me that the surveillance practice of the IMF may perhaps need to be re-examined as well, because we have a global financial market which is very much dominated by global financial capital. And surely if the goal is global financial stability, that the IMF may need to reform in this area as well by targeting not just states but also the global private financial sector.
Was that a question or a comment?
A question.
To whom?
It seems to me that this is an important part of the reform.
Right,
the IMF is there also for global financial stability.
Right.
Well, I don't think I have an answer. I mean, I thought that I understood that the IMF were engaging with non-state organisations in recent years. They have a program of engaging with NGOs and so on within countries. I as I understand, recognising increasingly their political, the fact that they're not just economic organisations, but they're political as well. But I mean, they've not really been doing their job. I don't think the problem is that they haven't been doing that. I think, as Ariel said, they haven't been ensuring global economic stability, which means not just looking at the countries in deficit that need a bailout, but also looking at those with a surplus as well, and who also have an equal role in ensuring financial stability. And I mean, this was part of Keynes's original plan, I think, which predated the IMF, which was never implemented. I think it's much more ambitious, but I don't know the answer to your question though. Some comments.
Do you have a step?
I agree with what Dennis said. Of course, dealing with NGOs and such was essentially public relations. It was really, this is the rules, we make the rules, we are the powers, and so forth. Now, in the current crisis, they found that India, China, Brazil, Mexico, whatever, say, hey, why don't you invite us to the Financial Stability Forum? Why is it that it's only European countries and the US and maybe one or two others that are involved? But they are involved, it's mostly countries that have been traditional creditors. But you have to have the point of view of other countries on the other side of the table that may have something to say as to how you deal with things. So that's something I think that's going to happen. And of course, you really need to restore a degree of symmetry to the adjustment process. Now, as long as the surplus countries do not help overcoming the imbalances, it makes it very much more difficult for deficit countries to balance their books. If somebody has a surplus and saves the surplus and doesn't spend the money, say China, then somebody else has to work double to earn this. But if you've got people to follow appropriate exchange rate policies or sufficiently expansionary policies to overcome their surpluses, then it would be much easier for the others to adjust. So there is a problem of symmetry here and of the burden of adjustment and who carries this. This is a problem that's been there for a very long time. Now, as long as the US and Europe were the surplus countries, they didn't care. Now that the US has the largest deficit, they would like to see more movement on the part of the surplus countries. So we'll see.
I think actually that's probably all we really have time for. It's 8:10. We've run well past. I think I'd like to thank you all for coming, and in particular to give our thanks to the two speakers. Thank you very much.